Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi folks, welcome to episode 119 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I am joined, of course, by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about a small subject, the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Why that?
Well, it's just a great story.
Yeah.
One of the great set pieces in European history. And in Epochs, sometimes we do a really tight focus thing, almost one day's events. Sometimes it's much more broad strokes. This is going to be very, very broadly speaking. I'm going to do about almost 100 years of history here. So going to sweep through it.
But no view.
So one of the things to mention is that the fall of Rome is a set of events. Some people do say that they think they ascribe the fall of Rome to that they used lead pipes and it sent people mad. And it was the lead piping that led to the fall of Rome. That's just a nonsense. Get that out of your mind if that's what's in your mind.
There are dozens of reasons, but there are like obviously two or three like major socio-political events that lead to this.
Yeah.
And so it's obviously not just something as mechanical as there's lead in the pipes. They've had lead pipes for centuries. What now?
It's a set of events. It's a process that lasts a long time. Well, I'm going to do about 100 years here. Mm. And one of the things to say is that different historians pick different points. Mm. If you're going to pick one moment or one day or one emperor, say he was the last Roman emperor of the West.
Yeah.
Different historians pick different ones. So we're going to go through all of them, really, all the main candidates.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to say is that historians like, they're quarrelsome a lot. They like to argue over things.
Yeah.
You can say, some people do say, that the Eastern Roman Empire is a direct continuation of the Western Roman Empire. And so Rome didn't fall until the 13th century and the Fourth Crusade. Or some say even 1453, when the Ottomans finally besieged Constantinople for the last time. And but that's pushing it.
There is some legitimacy to this argument as well, because some would say, well, there's a legacy of continuity here, as in Rome conquered the Mediterranean basin. Constantine, a legitimate Roman emperor, because he won the Civil War, founds a new capital, Constantinople. This becomes the capital of the Roman Empire for however long. And then the empire is divided at late stages, but that doesn't change the legacy that's inherited, the continuation of institutions, of traditional legal practices, things like this, even when the empire definitely takes on a Hellenic tone.
Mm.
It doesn't have the sort of Latin character that the Western Roman Empire has, obviously. But you can, I think, successfully argue that, of course, it's the Roman Empire. That's how they thought of themselves at the time. That's what they were continuing on into the future. And definitely ends with Mehmed II's conquest of the city. So
that final fall of Constantinople in 1453 is just a great moment in history. If you're looking for a spot to sort of draw a line under things, that's sort of a perfect example of when you can draw a line under things. Like the Norman Conquest, 1066. You can draw a line there very clearly.
It's the end of the Saxon period.
And I would also agree that you can make the argument that the Eastern Roman Empire is in all sorts of ways a direct continuation of the Roman world.
Yeah.
They called themselves Greek, wrote and spoke in Greek after a while. But anyway, you can certainly make that argument. However, it's not sort of the classical Roman, they're not sort of the classical Western Roman Romans, if you know what I mean.
Everyone knows there's a kind of essence that's missing to this. I think I'd be most comfortable calling it a kind of successor state, which feels more appropriate, because there is a kind of essential Romanness that is missing.
Well, by the end, by 1453, it's really a shadow of a shadow of a... The real Byzantine Empire was destroyed in the late 13th century by the Fourth Crusade, by Franks, really. But so anyway, people argue about the real, if you like, the real Romans, the Western Romans, the Roman Romans. Because, of course, you could make an argument that, say, Justinian, the fall of the Western Roman Empire happened before and during the reign of Justinian in the 6th century. But he goes back and reconquers Italy briefly, you know, with Belisarius.
Very briefly.
And then you can say, well, when that falls, you could count Justinian as the one of the last, arguably the last Roman emperor. So some say there, that's a bit of a tenuous argument to make, but you can say that. Then there's a few emperors, more than one emperor, and this is what our story today is going to be about. There's more than one emperor in the West that's defeated by a barbarian, in inverted commas, usually Germanic, Gothic type peoples, or people from further afield. And so there's more than one of those. So you can point to that and say they're the last one. So the two guys that have got the best shout for it are Honorius, an emperor Honorius, and a later one, Romulus Augustulus, who was really just a child figurehead. So and I'll talk about all those. But still, even before you get to Honorius, who was defeated by Alaric, the Visigoth Alaric, there's a process, a long process before that. So if I just set that up, but before I set that up, I'd like to give a shout out to one of our fans, a chap who only goes by the name of Leon, who sent us in this book.
That inspired this episode.
Helmet and Spear by a historian called AJ Church. He said he bought it over 20 years ago for 20p in a charity shop. And it's a classic sort of light-hearted, fairly, you know, overview type book. There's all sorts of things in it about the ancient world. Roman and Greek world.
I had a read through the first sort of half, basically, just because it's a lovely old style read.
I love this sort of book.
Me too. These are the sort of things you give to like a teenage boy to teach him about like the classical world. You know, so it's not too in depth, so it's not going to swamp him with details. It'll just hit the major narrative beats that keep the stories interesting and vital, and so you know, and bring the battles to life and the great struggle and stuff. And this is the sort of thing that get a teenage boy into ancient history. It's a really good little thing.
Absolutely, they used to have like they used to call it boy's own, own stuff, like heroes from English history or from the ancient world or anything really. And anyway, I had to flick through it and read a bit of it, and it's just
it's great.
It sort of took me back to my childhood a bit, the sort of thing I would read.
Yeah.
And anyway, the last chapter in it was called Three Deadly Blows, which chronicles some of the events in that process of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And when I was reading it, I'll quote from it a little bit today. When I was reading it, it reminded me, well, he's just, A.J. Church there, he's simply paraphrasing Gibbon, Edward Gibbon.
I imagine a lot of people are.
So there's some sort of seminal texts. If you ever read almost anything or see a YouTube video or anything really about the 12 Caesars, whoever's telling that story is just relating Suetonius and or Tacitus. That's all pretty much all they're doing. Now, when it comes to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, most people are paraphrasing Edward Gibbon, an Englishman who was writing in the 18th century. And I'm familiar with Gibbon. And Gibbon's history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire is really, really long. Yeah. It's fantastically long.
I've never read it because it's just too big.
The audiobook will be tens of hours long, the unabridged version. The unabridged version will take up this much on your shelf.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite that much, but anyway, I've got more than one copy for some reason, somehow accumulated over the years, more than one copy of Gibbon. And I reread some of the bits, so I'm going to also quote from Gibbon a bit here. And so, yeah, whip through some of the sort of main events.
So what sort of year are we starting? About 350?
Okay, so, no, like the 370s.
Right.
But I will go back and explain a little bit of detail before that even. So not one of the, not the emperor, not Honorius, who was defeated by Alaric, but before that, about 35 years before that, the Eastern Roman Empire lost a massive battle. The Battle of Adrianople, which is a city. In fact, Gibbon calls it Hadrianople. So when I read the quote, Adrianople, Hadrianople, same thing. Modern day, it's Edirne, or Edirne.
As I remember, this was a massive crushing defeat to the Goths.
To the Romans.
No, the Romans were defeated by the Goths.
Yes, right.
The defeat was to them.
Right, I see. Yeah, that's right.
They were the ones inflicting it.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. But yeah, this was a seismic battle. Like, it was massive.
That's why I'm going to talk about it here and why AJ Church chose it as the first event in his three great events. Because Constantinople doesn't fall. It hasn't really got anything to do with the West. Well, it has got something to do with the Western Empire, but Rome itself isn't involved. However, when historians look back on it, at the sweep of history, it's impossible to not look at that battle and say that there are the seeds of Rome's ultimate destruction. Because, like I said, it's only about 35 odd years later when Rome itself falls for the first time to Alaric.
Mm.
And like I say, if you look at the whole sweep of things, you have to say, well, that was a turning point because it was as bad for Rome as Cannae.
Mm.
Their army wasn't wiped out to a man like at Cannae, but nearly, and it was a death blow. It was a death blow.
Mm.
Okay, so that is in 376 that happens. The emperor himself, the Eastern emperor, is Valens, and he's actually killed in that battle. The emperor himself is killed. So to set it up before, like 100 years before that even.
Sorry, just a quick thing here, just so people know.
Yeah.
Roman emperors don't normally die in battle.
Not often.
They die from intrigue most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's very rare, actually.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's momentous to have a Roman emperor die in battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once in a lifetime, sort of.
Yeah, much less than that, even. Well, yeah, right. Super rare. Yeah. It is. So about 100 years or so before that, there's an emperor, Aurelian, who sort of cedes Dacia.
Mm.
To
restorer of the world.
Yeah, he cedes Dacia to the Goths. Now, the word Goth is a bit like Scythian. It's a very broad umbrella term. And even within that, you've got the Ostrogoths, the Eastern Goths, and the Visigoths, the Western Goths. Even that is
underneath that. And these are broad confederations of culturally aligned Germanic tribes and some non-Germanic tribes as well. So it's very hard from an outside perspective to really gauge the composition of these things. And so most of the time, it's like Goths.
Sometimes the historians, people that someone like Gibbon himself is drawing from, like there's a historian called Aemilianus, and there's a poet historian called Claudian. Often they'll just say the Goths, or they'll just say the Visigoths.
Yeah.
And sometimes they will actually mention the names of the individual tribes within that. So I just wanted the audience to know that it's a very broad thing to talk about the Goths or even the Ostrogoths.
Yeah, I recently finished a book called The Story of the Goths. I can't remember who it's by now, but it was really, really good. And one of the main points they make about Adrianople is that essentially it's not Goths, really. It's everyone, but the main trunk of the army is Germanic Goths, people who would identify as that. But there are all sorts of other tribes that are kind of tacked on and in coalition with them, and it's just a mess to figure out.
And the same thing can be said of if you talk about the Vandals.
Yeah.
Same thing. Or if you talk about the Hun, same thing.
Well, the Huns are even worse because, I watched a documentary about the Huns that was implying that actually there's not really an ethnicity called Hun. It's more kind of a countercultural against the Romans. And it's hard to know. And
Romans themselves didn't really know.
Yeah.
Because the Huns are from China, basically, from Mongolia.
Hmm.
And sometimes they're called Tartars.
Hmm. There's definitely a confederation of steppe people that are doing something. But then, Europeans start adopting their mannerisms because they don't like Rome and things like this. It's just God, who knows? So anyway, it's complicated.
So about 100 years before Adrianople, one of the important Roman emperors, Aurelian, cedes Dacia, and I'll put a map up so everyone can see what I'm talking about, to the Goths. But it actually worked out quite well. The Goths were becoming Christianized, becoming a lot more civilized. They weren't out and out. Sorry?
Arians, though.
All right, yeah.
Can we really trust the Arians?
Yeah. Well, okay, so
they've got a very, very small point of doctrinal difference to the real Christians, I'm just saying.
There's another thing to mention. So we're talking about, we've already taken it for granted that everyone knows about the
Arian heresy.
Or that. And also the partition of the Eastern and Western Roman Empire. So just quickly to say on that. the Roman Empire grew so huge that it sort of had to be split up in the age of Diocletian, who comes just before Constantine the First, Constantine the Great, in the early 300s. He decides to split the Roman Empire into four, the Tetrarchy, with two Augustus, two Augusti, who are sort of the senior emperors, and below them two Caesars. So four sovereigns really control it. Constantine did away with all that and put it all back under himself. Now, in the decades after that, it sort of broke up and reunited many times in that period. The idea that there's sometimes a united and sometimes a partitioned Roman Empire all throughout the 4th century, it's on and off. Okay, so what seems to have happened is that some Hunnic people were invading from the east, whether they're from Tartary, or they're from the Mongolian steppe, or they're from China, or somewhere in Central Asia. Even the Romans didn't seem to know exactly.
Well, I was going to say, just to be clear, the maps that the Romans would have been using wouldn't have had anything definite in this region of the world. Well, they wouldn't have been very well explored. They wouldn't have been very well known. But essentially, here be monsters, and they'd have turned up with a very rough-looking steppe nomad face. God, the monsters have arrived. Because, again, just something we mentioned before, but every couple of hundred years throughout history, something awful comes off of the eastern steppes to Europe. It's just awful, and it does terrible damage, and then eventually it's either repelled or it settles. And it's just, this happens for literally like 2,000 years until the age of gunpowder, thank God.
I've got a great quote later that describes, before people were PC, describing the sort of Asiatic features.
Yeah, they're not complimentary.
And it's quite funny, actually. Yeah. Some Hunnic peoples were pushing some Goths into the Eastern Roman Empire.
This is where the narrative that immigration destroyed the Roman Empire, refugees destroyed the Roman Empire, comes from. And there's something to it.
And it seems, so the Roman Empire at that point had been divided between two brothers. There was an emperor, Jovian, who died without leaving an heir. And it goes to these two brothers. And the elder brother was a military man who took over as a military emperor. Valentinian the First. Now, there's multiple Valentinians in this and multiple Theodosiuses in this. So I'll try and help keep track of them for you.
They're very cinematic names, though, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So Valentinian the First was, he took the Western Roman Empire and gave the East to his brother, Valens, the Valens that dies in this battle.
Yeah.
So Valentinian the First seems to have been a real tyrant, like he sentenced people to death all the time for almost nothing, sort of a person. Apparently he'd be constantly be saying things like, "Oh, burn him alive then. I'll chop his head off then."
It wasn't that bad.
Yeah. Whereas Valens seems to, he wasn't quite as bad as that. He was nearly as bad as that, but not quite as bad. He was a bit more, he's described more sort of a scaredy cat type person.
Right.
Like he's always just scared of what's going to happen next, rather than just issuing deaths and not worrying about blood feud or anything. Valens isn't like that. So these brothers are really quite different people. Anyway, towards the end, when the battle starts, Valentinian, the elder brother in the West, has actually died, and his son Gratian, who's not very old, so Valens' nephew, is emperor in the West. And he'll come up tangentially. A.J. Church wrote, "In 375... they, the Eastern Romans, were disturbed by reports of an invading host which was advancing from the north and east. These reports pictured the newcomers as hideous in appearance and cruelly savage in character. We are now used to the Tartar countenance, but to the Europe in the 4th century, the broad, almost beardless face, flat nose, eyes wide, set wide apart, the squat figure were as frightful as they were strange. As for the savagery of the Huns, for so the newcomers were called, rumours were scarcely exaggerated." So it does say, so even the Goths were petrified of the Huns.
Yeah.
And they seem to have come in sort of countless numbers.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about Attila the Hun later. And yeah, just all the accounts are like, there's endless numbers of them.
Yeah.
We can't even begin to count them. There's that many.
I mean, and this... is because they're horse nomads, right? And so you've got a massive area that they've come from. But one of the things that the Mongols did is just take advantage of the mobility of the cavalry, right? And so it appeared that they were in all places at all times, but actually they were just moving very fast. There's actually a small number. So it's entirely possible there weren't that many of them. It was just reports. You hear a report there, and then a week later that gets there, but there's another report that's arrived there that was 2 days later or something, you know, and who knows, something, right? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's undoubtedly going to be a horde, right? Either way.
Just to put this in context for people who might not be aware, the Mongol invasion of Genghis Khan and his successors are the late 12th century, early 13th, throughout the 13th century.
Yeah.
So that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years after this.
Yeah.
You know, nearly 1,000 years after this, yeah. Best part of 1,000 years after this. But so
horse nomads have been a scourge for a long time.
Right, yeah. Sometimes they're just still called Scythians. The Romans were still just calling them the Scythians.
Mm. Who, from the classical era, were basically just horse nomads. Mm. So, again, a perennial problem that Europe had to deal with. And not just Europe either. But
so this Hunnic invasion sends the Goths into the Eastern Roman Empire. Now, the Romans have been up against that sort of thing since the days of Julius Caesar. During the days of Julius Caesar, there's a much more up in Germany, much more in Central and Western Europe. Mm. Suddenly, this exodus of refugees, essentially, comes flooding into your land because a yet more barbaric people beyond them have pushed them into your territory.
And this is huge numbers as well.
Yeah.
Like we're talking, what, 50, 60,000, something like that, isn't it?
In this story...
When the Goths arrive at the Roman border.
Here? Yeah. No, it's loads. They think it's like a million.
What, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they think maybe there was 200,000 fighting men,
Jesus.
Which suggests, and they've got all their women and children with them.
And they're armed as well.
Right.
Which is bloody silly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They let them in armed for some reason.
Well, I've got a quote here. So when they come across the Danube, the Romans, the Eastern Roman Emperor, Varus, and his counsellors, his ministers, have to make a decision what they're going to do. They have to do something. They have to deal with it.
What are we going to do with 200,000 armed fighting men?
Because in Caesar's day, he decides to sort of massacre a lot of them and say, no, you're not coming into Roman-occupied Gaul or Roman territory. I'm not going to allow it. Mm. You're stuck between a rock and a hard place now. Good luck. Well, Valens decides he'll let them in. And in fact, he'd be quite nice to them, or at least on paper, supposed to be quite nice to them. But one of his stipulations, again, on paper, was that we have to disarm you, though.
Yeah.
But then... His people didn't do that.
Mm-hmm. But so there's
that's
a question.
A mistake.
I mean, can the Roman army of the 4th century deal with 200,000 Goths? Because, I mean, like we say, well, why didn't he just do that? Well, he might be looking at his 50,000 men and being like, they can't handle this.
He might not have been able to.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Like, and the only way to keep the peace and stop them from just killing the army and then burning down Gaul is to kind of cooperate. And so...
Right, yeah. Yeah. If there's someone much bigger than you...
Yeah.
Insisting they're taking your pocket money, you can refuse and take the beating, or you can just give it to them, right? it's easier in a way, just to give them your pocket money.
Maybe we can manage the problem after the fact, you know.
Yeah. And so he even ferries them across the Danube. And there's a quote here from A.J. Church saying, having thus allowed them to remain formidable because they didn't take their weapons off them, the Romans proceeded, with almost incredible folly to insult and oppress them in every possible way.
Yeah.
They robbed them of their wives and children and sold at extortionate prices the food which the imperial government had bound to provide without cost. So it seems like Valens's bureaucrats just took advantage of the situation.
Yeah, totally exploited them and gave them a just cause to really hate the Romans. I mean, okay, you've stolen my family and now you're putting me... I mean, some of them had to sell their own children to feed themselves. It's like, okay, why are you doing that again? Because, I mean, like a more prudent policy, and I'm sure one Valens was thinking of, would have been, okay, well, then take small groups of them and just ferry them around the empire, settle them down, and then we've got more manpower.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, when historians look back on it, it just seems like Valens and the Eastern Roman establishment are just making all the wrong decisions, just again and again and again. A really key decision which could have prevented you from a disaster.
Yeah.
You did the wrong thing.
Because, I mean, you had the option when you're ferrying them across to ferry as many as you could deal with and then just get them processed. right? And you've got that option. Like, they're not going anywhere else. They need you to get the cross. So you have the option there. And for some reason, they just don't take it. I mean, I'm sure they had good reason for what they were doing, or maybe they were just evil. Who knows? But, it's just really obviously in hindsight, this was a bad idea.
And so here now, the Eastern Roman world is flooded by both Visigoths and Ostrogoths, both types of Goth. Maybe a million of them, maybe 220,000 fighting men, armed mostly, are in your territory. And now, and on top of that, actively pissed off.
Yeah.
That you're sort of oppressing them.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I can understand the Roman position. It's like, oh, look, 200,000 or a million Goths have turned over and they want Gibbs. I'm very sympathetic to the anti-Gibbs argument. I can see where the average Roman taxpayer was like, why the hell should I pay for them? They shouldn't even be here. You know, send them to Rwanda to be processed. I can totally understand it. But it's a different world and they are armed and the government is feckless and incompetent.
And so where they could have perhaps in another, if it had worked out differently, they might have been able to team up against the shared foe of the Hun. They don't. So basically a war breaks out between the Goths, mainly Visigoths, but also Ostrogoths, against the Eastern Romans. And sort of straight away, the Eastern Romans are sort of hard pressed. They've already had Valens has already had many wars with sort of more Persian type peoples in Anatolia. So he wasn't even residing in Constantinople. He'd been residing in Antioch for like 4 or 5 years already. So there's another whole theatre of combat and things going on there.
Dealing with Sassanids or something, right?
All sorts of...
Whoever it is.
Yeah, right.
The perennial Iranian empire that they have to fight.
And the other thing that historians look back on, just briefly, quickly to say, is that the Roman generals, after the main influx of the Goths across the Danube, should have then, at the very least, sort of secured the Danube frontier again against later incursions, and they didn't do that either. So again, it sets up, when you can zoom out and look at the whole thing, you can say, well, that was further down the road, decades further down the road. That's a fail. Again, a pretty bad sort of fatal error sort of thing. So there's a battle at Pravadi, a place called Pravadi. Another one near Varna, a place called the Willows. Not sure exactly where that is. A few big battles, which basically go the Goths' way, more or less. Anyway, they keep pushing down into where is now modern Edirne. Adrianople. And Valens decides that he's going to, he returns from Antioch to Constantinople and decides he's got to march out to meet them, because although he's sort of fairly cowardly type person, he's not, that's still not our type of a coward, i.e. a real craven. He's still prepared to go out and fight in a battle, but just
necessary.
He's not like an Alexander type.
No.
He's not a Henry.
But I mean, if you're the emperor and you've got hundreds of thousands of barbarians running around sacking things, you've got to deal with it. It's just your job.
So he marches his army, the Eastern Roman Imperial Army, out to Adrianople. And the Gothic horde is camped a few miles away from it, about 10 miles away from it. And his counselors say to him, look, we're sort of in home territory here. Their supply lines, if you can even call it that sort of thing, their logistics, they're a long way from home, and we're right near home. What we should probably do is, the longer we leave it, the better for us. Mm. We should try and starve them out. They can only live with the land for so long. And also Gratian's coming from the west with an army. Mm. We've even got a letter here saying, where Gratian, his nephew, Valens' nephew, saying, wait for me, we should team up. You know, we need to try and make sure of this victory. But Valens decides no. He doesn't want to share any of the glory with Gratian. And he was of the mind that it was just sort of dishonourable or something to starve them out. He sort of wanted to win a glorious victory.
I mean, that is the Roman attitude towards war. But, how did that victory go?
Not too well. This AJ Church says,
famously quote, bad, in fact.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.